Here at The Guardian, we love podcasts. Not only do we make dozens of award winners ourselves, but we also write about our favourite podcasts from around the world too. Every week, our column Hear Hear, that's here as in hearing and here as in where, comes out filled with recommendations from you, our listeners. We sift through them all to find the hidden gems that the podcasting world has to offer. These podcasts are often small yet mighty productions, which you probably wouldn't find highlighted on your usual podcatchers. So, if you're looking for your next podcast or have one that you want to share with the world, sign up for our weekly Hear Hear newsletter at theguardian.com/podmail and send us an email at podcasts@theguardian.com.
Hello and welcome to the Books Podcast with me, Sian Kane. On the show this week, we have Samantha Harvey in to talk about her new novel, The Western Wind. But right now, I am joined in the studio by Claire and Richard to talk a little bit about what we're reading at the moment. I will start us off. I'm reading a novel called White Houses by Amy Bloom, which is coming out in May. It's actually already out in the US because it's a novel about Eleanor Roosevelt and a real-life love affair that she had with a journalist called Lorena Hickok, who basically was assigned to cover the White House, developed this very intimate relationship with Roosevelt, and ended up moving into the White House with the Roosevelts and quit her job as a journalist, obviously, because there was a bit of an ethical conundrum involved.
an unconventional ménage à trois.
Yeah.
So what era is this then?
So just after the Depression. Hmm. And it was actually, basically, it was only discovered quite recently that they had such an intimate relationship because some love letters between the two of them were discovered, and the language is very intimate. Mm. So it's a beautiful little portrait of, it's also the politics and the time as well. And Lorena, like, I don't know anything about Lorena, the real Lorena, but certainly out of this novel, she seems like a very complex woman. So I'm very excited for everyone to read it because I think it's wonderful. And I'm also reading this book called God Save Texas, which is a big sort of sprawling nonfiction, a portrait of the state of Texas, which seems like a very weird place. I've never been to America, but it seems quite strange. How about you, Richard? What are you doing?
I'm in the middle of a debut, which is due in June, from a barrister called Sarah Langford, called In Your Defence. It's some kind of series of portraits of, or sometimes amalgamated portraits of clients, which throw light on the legal system and the kind of what it's like to be caught up in that. It's very strong. It's very good.
Mm. Claire, I mean, what have you been reading?
Well, I'm entering festival season, and that means I do a lot of reading, sort of retrospective reading. And this week and last weekend, and in fact the last couple of weeks, I've been reading Brian Aldiss, who, as you probably know, died last year, aged 92, with something like 80 books behind him. Mm. And I was reading his Heliconia trilogy because I was doing a platform on him. It was that his papers have just gone into Oxford's Bodleian Library alongside Franz Kafka and Philip Larkin, which is rather amusing because he was one of the points that was made during this tribute afternoon was that in five major literary surveys between 1977 and 2007, and this was of the novel and of the short story, only in one of those did Aldiss get a passing mention. So he has been sort of airbrushed purely because of being largely a generic writer.
Well, he's quite a weird man in that he was really, he did a lot of sci-fi. He also did a lot of sort of literary fiction and seemed to do both with the same sort of degree of respect from his peers and from critics. So you were doing this event at the Oxford Literary Festival and you were talking about his career. Who else was on the panel?
Well, particularly, it was me and Philip Pullman. There were two panels, various writers. And Philip Pullman is very keen for his Dark Materials not to be seen as science fiction. And but being Oxford, there were quite a few very high-powered scientists in the audience, including a particle physicist and Roger Penrose, who worked with Brian Aldiss on White Mars, one of his novels. And they were claiming that they saw their work in his fiction in the dust.
These sort of particles that sort of embody, it's almost like a magical particle that exists in his Dark Material books.
And that interact differently with children to adults as well.
Yeah,
they're quite mysterious little bodies.
They can kind of communicate as well, kind of via kind of magic-y stuff.
Yeah.
So why does he resist the idea that it's science fiction?
Well, what he said is science science provides brilliant stories, so why wouldn't you use it? So he basically gens up on enough science to be able to keep the story going forward. So it's not based on science. Mm. He doesn't want to be it to be considered scientific. Whereas Brian Aldiss based Heliconia, his trilogy, 1980s trilogy, on James Lovelock's theory of Gaia, which in those days was quite controversial.
And not very scientific at that time.
Was not thought to be scientific. And what's fascinating reading it now is that we really have come round to it. Mm. So it's this universe which has two suns, and he's talking about what does it do to time and to seasons if you have two suns, one very far away and one close. And one of the things it means is that you have very, very long seasons. And so very, very cataclysmic big things happen. Well, look what's happening to us now. quite apart from the fact that it was subsequently discovered that there is a planet with two suns. But also it's very carefully researched the ecology of how these planets are managed. Like, they start off living underground in this dark civilization, so they have to have noctiferous barley, which, i.e., it grows by night. And then there's the system about they have mushrooms are very important, and how do you fertilize the mushrooms? Well, obviously you do it with night soil because you have a lot of human excrement to get rid of if you're not. And it's just it's very, very clearly anchored, although there's no preaching in it in that particular one at all, so you wouldn't really know it when you read it. You just read it like a Yomping story. But it did raise, before I went, we were a bit worried, weren't we? We were having a discussion in the office about what the difference between fantasy and science fiction is. And actually, when I started reading Heliconia, it reads like a fantasy, and that's what I would have thought it was. I would have thought it's in the same camp as his Dark Materials. Mm. But no, because of this underpinning. But the science fiction writer Christopher Priest, who gave one of the sessions, was saying part of the good science fiction has to have a moral purpose. It's not just about bits of spacecrafts and machinery and technology. Richard, do you agree with that? You're more of a SF buff than I am.
I don't know. I mean, I think there's many SF writers who'd resist the idea that they're doing anything kind of particularly morally purposeful. I think there are many SF writers who'd just say it's a kind of toolkit that they can use to tell the stories they're interested in, about the characters that they're interested in. It's a way of addressing those issues rather than, I mean, I'm not sure Richard Morgan, who we interviewed earlier this year, not sure he would suggest that his tooled up future detective is in any way doing any kind of moral crusade.
Well, that's the debate that was raised a few years ago, and there's that ridiculous fight over the Hugo Awards, the Science Fiction Writing Awards, when there was this sort of band of authors forming this thing called the Sad Puppies, where they were basically campaigning against science fiction that was worthy in a way. You know, they wanted a return to just ships
boys
blowing
with toys.
Yeah, exactly. Ships blowing stuff up, and it's entertaining and it's fun, and it doesn't have to have a meaning, and it doesn't have to have politics in it, and that sort of thing. There was a lot of other baggage involved in that whole debate, but that was sort of one of the key things that they were kind of campaigning against, was this idea it had to be moral.
Except I don't think that any of the authors that they're objecting to would be saying that they were on any kind of moral crusade either. It's just that the stories they're interested in happen to involve people who aren't white and blokes.
And some of the authors they were championing were like, hang on a minute, I am moral.
yeah. But also, if you say it doesn't have to have politics, well, you know, if you don't have politics, that means you're defaulting back to the status quo, which means you nearly always default to the right, don't you?
Well, it's a politics in not having politics, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And in this session, there was some lovely stuff about how science fiction sits in the culture. And Aldiss always said a lot of it isn't defensible, a lot of it isn't good enough. And he probably, a lot of the puppies he wouldn't think were defensible. It's only worth defending the best, he used to say. On the other hand, he was judging, back in the 70s, he was judging a science fiction competition which Salman Rushdie's Grimus was submitted to.
It's infamously well-received, wasn't that?
It was going to win. And
right.
At the very last minute, his publisher withdrew it, to which Aldiss, who was rooting for it to win, his reaction was, from then onwards, he said, thank goodness he didn't, supposing Grimus had won the competition, from then onwards, poor Rushdie would have been branded an SF writer, and nobody, including presumably the Ayatollah and Hermione Lee, would ever have heard of him again. And then I was thinking, why Hermione Lee?
Yeah.
And my brain started going around. I thought, I know why Hermione Lee, because she was on the Booker jury with him in 1981 when the prize went to Rushdie, to Midnight's Children, ahead of Doris Lessing's The Syrian Experiment, which is one of her science fiction novels. And I think there's a bit of a feud there, because I happen to know that Aldiss was backing Doris Lessing at that point.
Does this come down to a snobbery thing, though? Because there's quite a lot of literary, inverted commas, capital L, authors that do dabble in sci-fi, but then
You come back to the Margaret Atwood
Yeah,
thing,
Margaret
don't
Atwood saying it's all talking squids in outer space, which it clearly isn't. And she clearly is writing science fiction. And there are people like, say, Naomi Alderman or Lauren Bucus who veer in and out of science fiction and write brilliant books. And it's sort of this idea that sci-fi is also some sort of brand of quality as well.
Yeah.
That it's going to be a lesser book because it's science fiction is kind of ridiculous.
Well, that also goes way back. And it's another quote that I absolutely love that came up at this conference was from Kingsley Amis, who was a huge fan of A Hand-Reared Boy, which was one of Aldous's non-science fiction novels. And he said, but we need sentences like the CIA had to be in this with the Martians. And he said, don't get too sodding literary and you'll have us all in your debt, said Kingsley Amis to Brian Aldous, which I thought was absolutely lovely. So there is a snobbery about it. And I think there is also a sense that it has a place. And it's lovely to see a literary figure like that honouring somebody for that particular side of his oeuvre.
Yeah.
Do you think there's a sort of generational thing going on as well? Because in the way that Margaret Atwood resists that label very strongly, a writer like David Mitchell, who also writes fantastical things and some science fictional things, is very happy with the idea that it might be considered one thing or other.
Well, there is an argument that we're in such a science fictional world now that, you know, if you talk about social realism, is actually science fiction now.
Yeah, well, we were talking about this yesterday because I said, oh, well, because we're talking about what is fantasy, what is sci-fi, and I said, oh, isn't sci-fi sort of looking at our future and drawing upon theoretical ideas as opposed to now? But then thinking about it, I think the difference is that a lot of science fiction, say maybe 50 years ago, was going, right, 2050, what is the world going to look like? Whereas now a lot of our science fiction is looking at where we are right now and maybe putting us in slightly different circumstances or drawing upon things that are very familiar to us right now and putting it in 30 years in the future. It does feel like a lot of science fiction is just very current.
Yeah, and I mean, that's what Margaret Atwood has always said, the stuff I write is about what's now. So, for example, the genetically modified Krakers in Oryx and Crake with their blue luminous bottoms. Well, that capacity for genetic modification existed when she was writing the book. Yeah. It's just that nobody actually had bred a whole tribe of them yet.
Yeah.
So, what Nick Harkaway says, that if you're writing a novel now and you don't include all the internet, mobile phones, all the kind of possibilities of genetics that are just exploding at the moment, then you're writing historical fiction.
Mm. Yeah, but then, you see, I'm going back to Brian Aldous again, there's that fantastic short story, Super Toys Last All Summer Long, which is the basis of Spielberg's AI.
Yeah.
And you're talking about a robot boy and what that means in a family. And actually, the robot boy is programmed to love his mother, but his mother only thinks of him as a toy.
Yeah.
And it's such a sad, such a profound meditation on certain, you know, certain dysfunctional family life, but it has a technological basis that is all too possible. I mean, we're all going to have our Tamagotchi or whatever they're called, aren't we, in the end? Or
There's always some sort of implication that literary fiction, in some sense, is doing the serious stuff and that science fiction or fantasy is some sort of escapism. What do you two make of that?
Oh, that's rubbish.
Yeah.
I mean, I love science fiction, and I think that there is this idea that science fiction is just sort of escapist fun and it doesn't mean anything. But if you look at some of the ideas that science fiction is considering, it's absolutely up there. I mean, this idea that literary, the term literary, is a sign of the quality of a book is absolutely rubbish. It's just, there's got to be some sort of capacity for people to start appreciating science fiction on a more sophisticated level.
Go, Sean.
Yeah.
Samantha Harvey's fourth novel, The Western Wind, is an unconventional murder mystery. A 15th century priest turns detective in his tiny, isolated Somerset village when a man is swept away by a river. Starting 4 days after the death and moving backwards in time, The Western Wind is a complex portrait of a secretive community. When she joined Richard in the studio, Samantha began with a reading.
2 years ago, I had a conversation with Newman. He told me that in Rome they have purpose-made boxes for confession. They don't kneel at the feet of the priest in the flat light of the nave, but enter a divided box with the penitent in one side, the priest in the other, a little dark box. The idea had, to me, beauty and mystery. I thought of this box as a church in miniature, a church within a church, the priest's side being the chancel, the penitent's the nave, and the screen between not so much that which divides the two as that which unites them, through which the two speak to one another. The ordinary man, freed by the discretion of the screen, tells the priest the things of his soul, so the priest can tell them to God and bring him closer to heaven. The screen no barrier, but a surface on which the holy mystery plays itself out. There'd have been no hope of us having a box like this, all things being equal, had our bishop not been punished for trying to disrupt the line of the throne, had our archdeacon not been too busy, had our rural dean not been inappropriately in charge and precisely the man he is, no, then this box wouldn't exist. When he, the dean, visited over a year ago at the start of that winter, I put the idea to him, the church within a church, the screen that unites, not divides, the play of holy mystery, etc. He was uninterested at best. At worst, he was offended. He muttered about Italians and sidled greyly across my hope like the cloud he so often is, a cloud that had lately found itself capable of producing rain. But the winter progressed. Winters can be savage things that persuade by force. We lost a lot that season, crops to flood, animals to snow, men, women and children to illness and hunger. I did my best, and so did we all, but in desperate times people do desperate things. They steal, they lie, they cheat, they despair, they forsake mass, they seek refuge in forbidden beds. When people are desperate, they do desperate things that they'd rather not tell their priest, who is a neighbour. Maybe it was the priest's bread they stole. Maybe the priest's friend's wife they went to bed with. The priest's sister, even. That Lent, which was the one before this, only half the village came to confess. I petitioned them every day in Mass. You must confess. You cannot take the host unconfessed. Still they didn't come. Then I began to notice increased comings and goings at Fourways, where the roads go out to Oak Hill, Bourne, Bruton and Foxhall. And when I followed someone, as if on a casual walk, I found what I'd already begun to know, that they were going a mile out of the village to meet a travelling friar who took their confessions there by the side of the road, with his hood heavy over his head. He could see them but didn't know them, and they never once had to meet his eye, not even to pass the coins into his purse. I told this to the dean. The money that should be staying in the village for tithes and donations is going out of it into a friar's purse for the sake of a confession given incognito. We're a small village with a river that may as well be a wall for all it keeps the world out. We'd be ruined as a parish if this custom of paying for a friar continued, I told him, and it was the truth. Money is a notion the dean can follow, not because he's shrewd or particularly opportunistic, but because he too is desperate, more and more as time goes on. The parishes he's been given charge of suffered that winter. And whose were those sufferings now, if not in part his? If there aren't enough people to see to the land and animals, and if half the animals have died, the village starves. And if the village starves, it looks to me, and I look to him, and he looks to the archdeacon, who looks to the bishop, and finds nobody there. And people lose faith because their protectors have not protected them. And the Lord loses faith in the protectors, whom he appointed to keep him in the hearts of all. Once the Lord has lost faith in you, you're upriver with no raft and one leg. And so, there we were, two men who had little time for each other, one having been lucky enough to stumble on the other's knottiest hate. To him, travelling friars were little but salesmen or frippers with as much spiritual authority. They were thieves and thugs. One had been found that was half beast, he said, with the body of a bear. I gave the dean ale and lamb by the fire, it was shortly after Easter, and I listened to his views. It was like having dank water seep over my feet to hear such passionless hate. But at the end of it, we joined hands weakly and made our concessions, he to a period of trial for a confession box, and me to installing it without more expense. Last winter, the wide oak door at the north entrance was replaced with a new one. We propped this old door against the southwest corner of the church to improvise a triangle of space for me to sit in. Philip down at Old Cross cut a hole in it, and his wife, Avi, wove a very passable hazel lattice to serve as a grill through which sins could be spoken. A curtain on the other side of it shields the penitent, who kneels between curtain and door. It's crude and childish. I don't know what the Italians would think. It probably looks like an animal den to them, not fit for the workings of God, more a little place for the workings of the bowel and bladder. Oakham, small and unknown Oakham, penned between river and ridge, has the only confession box in England, at least as far as we know. Maybe there are other Oakhams. We've never heard of another. Any bishop in the country would order the box to be torn out. Any bishop, that is, but one in prison, who hasn't had a thought for years about anything that wasn't his own life and how to prolong it. There are advantages to being forgotten.
So why did you want to tell this story in reverse? Was it to subvert the narrative logic of the whodunit?
Yeah, it was to shift it. Partly, there are several layers of answer to this question, but
because there is a body,
yes,
somewhere in this, and there is an investigation of sorts, but yes. It's not really a kind of crime novel.
No, it's not. So I wanted to take the well known tropes of the kind of murder mystery, but to try to shift it from a whodunit to a why done it, and I thought that's for me a more interesting question than who done it, and also a question that can be quite well explored going backwards, because you start to retrace someone's steps and the decisions they make and go back through their intentions until you get to the starting point. So that was part of the reason. And the other part, there are sort of two miracles that the priest asks for in the book, and one is for the wind of the title to blow from the west rather than from the east, and the other miracle is that he asks, quite unhopefully, if time could reverse, if God could reverse time and sort of undo what's happened, undo the death, undo sin, undo wrongdoing, and get him and his parish back to a state of sort of well-being and innocence.
A state of grace.
Exactly. So the notion of this hope, and it is only a hope, it's not a belief in him. He doesn't have any belief that God is going to grant this miracle. But this hope that time could be reversed is then reflected in the structure of the book.
Novel. Because it's the 4 days, isn't it, after the death of Tom Newman.
Yeah.
But told piecewise, day by day, going forward through each day, but then backwards, as it were.
Right, so it's quite a confusing structure. It's sort of quite a bellyful for the reader, because you're going forwards through the days and then you're jumping back 48 hours to the morning of the previous day.
Was it also about John Reeve's reliability as well?
Yes. So there's that a sense of not quite wanting to get to the point, not quite wanting to say what's happened, wanting to lay out all the reasons for what you did before saying what you did. So there's that element of trying, as we all do, to kind of manipulate what's happened to make us look a bit better.
It's not only told, as you say, stepwise backwards, but there's also a kind of mirror in the middle with the chapters reflecting each other. What's the kind of appeal of this intricate structure?
Yeah, that sort of came partway through the writing of the book. That's sort of the palindrome of the chapters. And that was partly just a playfulness and a recognition as I was going through that I could mirror them and I could end up where I started from. But also, again, to try to use structure to reflect a theme in the book, which is that of the sort of the roundness and the circularity of time, and to try to reflect some of that sense that I think is always there, but must have been there more in the Middle Ages, that you're living in the natural world, which has its circular rhythms. So that was partly what that structure is there for, to just give the sense of not just the backward movement of time, but the idea that it's a circle, and if it's a circle, it could go backwards as well as forwards. So it's all a way of playing with structure to try to just tease out some of the themes of the book, but for that not to matter if the reader isn't reading all of that into them, you know.
Because time is not only do you have the seasons coming back again and again, but nevertheless we get older, we grow up, we marry, we die. It's both things at the same time.
Yes.
And exactly. So the book is again structured both ways at the same time.
Yes.
And this is something that you do for your own pleasure or
for the structure of it.
Yeah. Yeah. You say this because a reader may or may not pick up on it, of course. But this.
Yeah. I think writers need to amuse themselves. I think something I've realised 4 books in is that something like 85% of the things that you've put into your book are missed by readers. And that you have to just be fine with that and accept that you have to keep yourself amused through the process. And then once in a while, someone will notice and you feel jubilant. Paid off.
Finally. Your first three novels are all set in the modern world. So why did you want to go back to the Middle Ages for this one?
I didn't particularly. I landed there by accident.
Just without knowing it?
Yeah.
So where did you set off from that got you there?
I set off from the point of wanting to write about confession. Mm. And I had wanted to write something about confession for quite a long time. And I thought...
Have you got something to confess?
I must have, mustn't I? I really liked the idea of that intensity of two people in an enclosed space. One reluctantly, perhaps, sort of unburdening their soul to the other.
But feeling that they ought to or had to.
But yes, exactly. So in particular, religious confession, not just confession of one friend to another or sort of legal confession, but religious confession. But I really resisted the idea for a long time because I thought, I don't want to write an impossibly quiet and claustrophobic novel with two people confessing.
In a box.
In a box. I can't do that to myself or my reader or my publisher. So I put the idea aside, but then I went for a walk one day, as writers do. And actually, the idea for this novel came to me quite fully. And it came in such a way that I saw it was necessary to set it at a time where confession was the norm, the societal norm. So that started working backwards through the years and the centuries. And I ended up back in the late 1400s in a bid in part to avoid the Reformation.
But it's there looming in the background, isn't it?
It's there. Yeah. And I set it in the late 1400s because it seemed to me, at least symbolically, a time of that moment just before change. Things were changing then, you know, huge things were shifting. But then there's that really symbolic change in 1492 of America being discovered. And then later in the 1500s of the Reformation and then modernity beginning. And so I wanted to just locate that moment just before
These ideas
changed.
Are part of everyone's world. They're all very well accepted, but they're kind of fraying at the edges.
Yes, exactly. And you, as a resident of Oakham, quite cut off from the world, you wouldn't really know they were fraying at the edges, and you wouldn't really know that your lifestyle and everything you know is under threat. But it is, and it's sort of looming there just out of sight. And yet maybe there are ways in which it's felt sort of subsonically. You know, I think we do have a sense of change coming, even if we can't quantify it. So I wanted to explore all of those things. Do people who are living on the cusp of a momentous historical change have any inkling that they are?
Is that partly because you feel that we're living on such a cusp at the moment?
Yeah, I do. I do, and I mean, that might be a false alarm. Maybe we're not, but I feel like we are. But it's such a different world now that we're all more aware that we are.
And this kind of this feeling, this subsonic feeling, is one you share.
Yeah, I think it is, and of anxiety about the future, and also a willful ignorance to not think about it too much.
Not looking it straight in the eye.
Yeah, just to pretend it's all going to go on as it is.
So having arrived almost against your will at the end of the 15th century, how did you go about getting to the head of a priest in a small village living then?
Well, I started out with an Osborne children's book about the Middle Ages.
Good place to begin.
Yeah. I knew less than anybody else in the world about the Middle Ages. So I started there. And I gradually upped my game.
And this was delving in libraries? This was going on visits to old houses?
It was mainly through reading books. And then it became more and more focused and in depth.
And was it more a question of the props, as it were, the scenery? Or was it really about the mindset?
It was both. I'm always interested in the mindset, and that's what the book is about. So trying to occupy the mindset of a priest who feels his position is being threatened. And who worries for his parish, and who is in a state of anxiety and torment to some degree. So that was the main thing.
It's still a massive part in the village's life, a kind of focal point for everything.
Yeah, yeah. As priests were, immense responsibility that a priest has had to deliver the whole world to his parish, because most of them couldn't read or write. They had to live by the scriptures, but they couldn't read them. So everything they knew about them came from him. All their moral education or their money, their everything, their forgiveness for sins, their afterlife, everything was taken care of by the priest. So he has this huge responsibility, which is, as we know, often abused. But also there's a intention there to do good, and I wanted my priest to be a priest who really was trying to do the best for his parish.
Even if he doesn't always succeed. But for all that it's kind of steeped in this mindset of the late 15th century, you've told it in a kind of muscular contemporary English. Did you ever think about going back to the language of that period?
I thought about it for a second.
A whole second?
A whole second. Could have even been 2 or 3 seconds.
And why did you decide not?
I wouldn't know. I didn't know how to. I didn't know how to approach such a sort of radical shift in language without making the book feel dusty and historical. And I was really concerned, as a lot of historical novelists are, I suppose, that with making their characters feel modern to themselves, because we always are modern to ourselves. So if you write about them in a historical language, you automatically thrust them into the past, but they're not in their own past. So then you create this strange sort of narrative gap. And I didn't want to do that. I wanted it to be narrated in such a way that it felt to us that we were in their moment, not that we were looking back from our moment. So I wrote it with a very modern syntax and very modern sensibilities, but tried never to be obviously anachronistic, and tried to give a sort of a music or a flavour of the time without having to be too faithful to the language of the time.
Almost paradoxically, in order to convey the experience of being what it was like to be in the past, you need all the kind of tools of the contemporary writer's trade.
I think that's right, you do, because otherwise you flag up, this is the past, where what you actually want is for the reader to think, as they're reading, this is now, this is real, this is true to me.
That it's happening.
Yeah, it's happening.
Yeah. You've got a certain amount of form as well with slightly older characters. With your previous 3 novels feature a retired widower, 2 middle-aged brothers and a middle-aged woman reflecting on a broken marriage. Is that just because your protagonists need to have a certain amount of lived experience?
I'm not sure why that is. I mean, actually, my priest in this, John Reeve, is probably not very old. I imagine he's around 30, but he would seem much older.
He's lived, it says, 13 Oakham winters, and he's going to be bald soon, we say. So, I mean, compared to the people around him, he's certainly a person of the older generation. He looks back on the young men who are you know, getting drunk and falling into as kind of a very different species. Even if he's, I mean, of the time, not very old, I suppose, in terms of our number of years.
Relative to his own peers, yes. Yeah, I don't know what the fascination is with older narrators, but I am really interested in and somewhat fearful of aging. And I think some of the richest questions of life come the older you get. And those are the ones I like to explore. So I always come back to this whenever I talk about writing. Maybe it's partly because if my characters are older than I am, they've been somewhere I haven't. So I then have to take that imaginative leap to get to them. And I seem to need that leap in order to write fiction. I can't write about anything that's too close to myself, because I need to be able to make a very real, tangible leap in my own mind to say, this is fiction, this is something I'm making up, and then I can run with it. So perhaps by writing about characters who are older and have been somewhere I haven't, that makes it more possible, which is partly why I seem to often write from a male point of view as well.
Is that part of the attraction of setting a book in the past as well?
I guess it is, yeah.
Or was that a pleasure that you discovered during the writing of this?
It was a pleasure. Yeah, I really enjoyed it. There's something quite freeing about it, quite liberating, because once you've decided on your world and your parameters and you've researched it and you feel confident enough to write something about it plausibly, you then have this space that is boundaried. You know, it's not shifting under your feet all the time as the present moment is. It's set there. And you need to make it alive, but still it's a boundaried space. And within that, then you can be much freer to just play in that space, to just play around with language, play around with themes. And you have this benefit of looking back and of being able to have some perspective on it that you don't have of the present. So it was a very different experience, and it was more pleasurable in a way than writing about the present. In a funny way, slightly less challenging for me.
Is it something you're going to return to again? Now you've got a taste for it.
I don't know. I really don't know. And I don't know what counts as the past either, because we talk about historical novels, but actually most novels are set in the past to some degree.
It takes 6 months at least to get right. one out the door, doesn't it?
Right, at least, yeah. So I don't know what counts as a historical novel. Does that sort of denote some genre as well as just being set in the past? Does that come with some sense of genre and of expectations and of writerly etiquette? I don't know. I don't know what I'll do next.
You began your career studying philosophy. What's the kind of relationship between your philosophical investigations and your fiction?
Well, when I started to study philosophy, I had an interview at university and I was asked which philosophers or which books of philosophy I liked. And I pulled out a couple of philosophical novels. And I was told very clearly that that wasn't philosophy, and that I needed to go away and think again.
Which were the philosophical novels that you hit on?
Oh, you know, being an 18-year-old, I think it's surely there was some Camus in there and Milan Kundera.
And this was not serious enough for the Academy.
It's not philosophy. It's just literature. It's just fiction. It's only not philosophy. That. Yeah. So I thought, oh no, that's not philosophy. I must go and try harder. So I went away and I did my philosophy degree. I couldn't lose this love of ideas as they present themselves in fiction. I think that's the best expression for ideas. And one of the hardest as well, because there's something at odds with ideas and narrative movement, you know, forward movement, and not getting bogged down, but going forwards. So it's something that is an endless challenge to me, to try to present ideas in a narrative way. The fascination has never left me, and I've come back having done a philosophy degree and then doing postgraduate philosophy and being poised to do a PhD and then thinking, God, no. I came full circle back round to fiction again, but this time writing it. So it's that investigation of ideas in a dramatic form that really appeals to me.
So like your novel, you're both moving forwards in your philosophical investigations and turning around, going back to the beginning.
Yeah. More or less. Yeah, it's just finding that way. It's very easy to write ideas badly. It's very easy. And it's just finding that way of making them, as Kurt Zia says in one of his essays, of finding ways of making your ideas walk and talk and of getting them out and about in the world. It's endlessly difficult and endlessly fascinating to me.
That was Samantha Harvey with Richard Lee. The Western Wind is out now and published by Jonathan Cape. Next week, classicist Mary Beard is interviewed by her erstwhile student and all-time fan Charlotte Higgins about the ups and downs of being a woman of power in a time of assassination, if not by gladiators, then by social media. Please subscribe and review us on all your favourite podcatchers and join the discussion on Twitter or by leaving a comment on the podcast page. What are your thoughts on the division between science fiction and fantasy? We'd love to hear from you. And if you'd prefer to contact us directly, you can email us at bookspodcast@theguardian.com. But for now, from me, Sian Kane, and our producer, Susanna Trezillian, goodbye and thank you for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.